Disruption Zone. Opportunity lives where the status quo dies. Talking to the greatest innovators, disruptors, and off-the-wall inventors we can scrounge up. You laugh, you'll learn, you'll be inspired. Now, here are your hosts, Leland Conway and Cameron Mills.
It is the Disruption Zone. The Pegasus Institute is really an awesome organization that has done an awful lot of good for the state of Kentucky. They've come in and done a lot of research on various different policy things. And like everyone right now, they're shifting to take a look at what's going on with the coronavirus. And I want to welcome back to the podcast Josh Crawford with the Pegasus Institute, who's working from his home like everyone else, practicing social distancing. How's that going for you, Josh?
Yeah, we're doing pretty well. The dogs are pretty happy to have us home. So,
yeah, but I bet if you have, you don't have a cat, do you? My wife's got a cat. The cat is not happy about us being home all the time.
No, just two dogs, and they're loving it.
They're like, "Hey, pet me. I'm good." So, you know, a lot of people are trying to make these adjustments to this new reality that appears to be something that's going to be with us at least for the coming weeks and possibly a couple of months, and who knows what beyond that. But one of the keys to this coronavirus battle is, and one of the things that I've been talking about, really, I'm very passionate about this, and I know you guys are going to probably be on board with it as well. We have to start hearing our political leaders talking about a reemergence plan. And I realize this is a fluid situation. It's a virus that we don't know an enormous lot about. But it would be really nice if the next, you know, press conference we see with all these talking heads, somebody got up and said, look, if we hit these benchmarks, if we get this much testing done and we get this many masks and this many respirators and the equipment gets put on par with where we need to be, then we can start letting people back outside the house again. If these benchmarks are hit, we can do this, and we believe we'll hit these benchmarks in this many weeks. That would give some level of surety, optimism, and hope to the American people and by extension the American economy, instead of just every time hearing that this could go on for some open-ended amount of time and you're all going to be stuck in your homes until then. Do you agree?
Yeah, absolutely. I think part of the reason you haven't heard that is that a lot of these folks just don't know yet. I mean, you hear 18-month timelines, you hear 4-month timelines, you hear 60-day timelines, you hear 14-day timelines. And all those things may represent different levels of return to normalcy. But I do think there needs to be a more concise, like, hey, if we can get to this point, then we're going to be in a place where we can start to return to that normalcy.
Well, and Councilman Piagentini, Anthony Piagentini, Louisville Metro Councilman, made a comment that I think was really important. And it's not a popular thing to say, but it's the truth. And that is that people are going to die from this virus. The problem that we have is not its death rate, really. It's worse than the flu. But it's not like magnitudes worse than the flu. I mean, when we're talking about half a percentage point or a tenth of a percentage point, yes, it's magnitudes worse. But the bottom line is, really, the people that this kills are mostly people who have pre-existing conditions. What's going to kill more people is if it overwhelms our hospital capacity. So the key number is not have we defeated the virus, but do we have the capacity for the number of people that might need to go in and be treated acutely to save as many of those lives as possible? And that is something we could figure out finite. We should be able to say in 6 to 8 weeks, we'll have all the respirators we need. You know what I mean?
Right. Yeah, that's this whole flattening the curve thing, right?
Yeah.
How do we keep this from overwhelming the healthcare system so that we can not only treat it appropriately, but recognize that there are going to be other acute healthcare needs during this time period.
Right.
Here in Kentucky and all over the country, hospitals are no longer doing elective surgeries and things like this. But if you're in a car accident today, that can't be put off.
Right.
If you're one of these shooting victims here in Louisville, that can't be put off. And so how can we get to a point where we not only have the capacity to deal with this in a manageable way, but also account for those acute medical needs that will pop up?
Right. So one of the things you guys have been doing is following the testing side of it. And the testing side of it, I think it's crucial, because I think what we'll find is that there's a lot of people out there who have the virus, don't know it, and will never know it. They're not going to show symptoms, especially the younger people. So, you know, everybody saw those pictures of these jackwagon kids down at the beach in Florida. And I think Florida is going to become our own version of Italy in the not too distant future, because you have these people coming in. It's almost like Italy in the sense that it's a tourist destination. You had a bunch of young people who probably don't know they have it, bringing it into a population that's largely older and has pre-existing conditions. I'm keeping my eye on Florida because I think it could be the next explosive epicenter of this. But when we can test people, then we can say, look, you have it. You may not feel bad, but you have it. You need to stay home for 3 weeks until this thing fully gets out of your system. And you guys are following those numbers. What are you seeing that's encouraging, discouraging? Where's Kentucky as compared to other states? Where are we in this?
Yeah, the really encouraging thing for Kentucky is that we are testing a higher rate of our citizens per capita than most of our neighbors, and we are having a lower positive test rate per capita than most of our neighbors. And so we have higher numbers of testing, lower positive tests. That's really good news for the state.
Right.
What that tends to show is, unlike some of our neighbors, the sort of social distancing type things here seem to be working. It's particularly relevant because one of the things that people have said is, oh, Kentucky is a rural state. This tends to affect larger and more urban states. But of course, most of our neighbors are relatively rural, if not equally or more rural than we are.
Yeah.
And we're still doing more tests per capita, and we're still having fewer positive test results per capita.
Well, and there's also a big difference between Kentucky rural and, say, Arizona or Nevada rural, right? Like there's it's rural in that it's not, you know, apartment complex after apartment complex, but there's not really any part of Kentucky, unless you get into Daniel Boone National Forest, where you're not always on somebody's farm or passing someone's farm. So that's interesting that those numbers are down, and you say it indicates that maybe we're following instructions a little bit better, right?
Yeah, I think part of it is that. I think part of it is, for better or worse, the decisions that have been made by elected officials here have been pretty decisive. And so I think the pain from that is more real, but I think the benefit from that is more real as well.
Right.
To the point that you made earlier about what the other side of this looks like, that's not a conversation that really has gone on here in Kentucky yet.
Yeah.
But from a... this is what we're going to do. We're going to do it. It's going to hurt, and we're going to get through this together. I think the state has really rallied around that pretty well.
Well, and I've been watching other states. For instance, Colorado's governor basically put together an economic panel and said, here, we need to figure out how we're going to get out of this. I think that kind of, and I sent that news article to several state legislators yesterday, and they all responded affirmatively. So I'm hoping that what we'll see in the coming days is, because I don't in any way, shape, or form just refuse to make this podcast partisan at this point, at least on this issue. And I think that Governor Beshear, maybe I haven't agreed with everything he's done, but I think his heart is definitely in the right place. I think he's deeply concerned. I think he wants to do what's best for Kentucky. I just want it to come to his attention that we have got to start talking about the economic recovery on the backside, what I'm calling the post-corona reemergence plan, and every state needs to have one.
Absolutely. And I think you're starting to see some states move on this in terms of waivers of occupational licensing requirements for
yes.
certain professions. I think you're seeing this with deregulation at both the federal and the state level. Both in the short term to try to get goods to market more quickly, but also with the recognition that the rebuilding process of this will be quicker if there are fewer government barriers. And I think that's one of the things that especially people who think like we do need to be talking about, that
right.
any sort of economic stimulus that is a part of this, whether it's checks cut or temporary tax relief or things like that, needs to be coupled with allowing the American people to do what the American people do so well, which is innovate, be resilient, and sort of the proverbial pull themselves up by their bootstraps. If
yeah.
government can get out of the way, then especially on the small business side of this, I think you will see that resurgence.
Yeah, you better watch it. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez won't like what you just said about pulling yourself up by your bootstraps. I don't know if you saw that. It was hilarious. She's like,
well,
you can't
her and Ted Cruz are retweeting each other right now.
Oh,
so the world truly is upside down.
We are definitely in the apocalypse. That's the third horseman, I'm pretty sure. Let's talk about that for a minute, though. This idea of deregulation that we're seeing, which I think is interesting, because on one hand, I'm seeing a few, you know, knobheads out there who are like, look, this shows we need socialism, which is totally not true. What I'm actually seeing is an affirmative or an affirmation of capitalism, of free markets, where exactly what you said, to the extent that anything is getting done in combating this disease, it's because private sector companies are stepping up at a rate we haven't seen since World War II, doing volunteer stuff. I mean, we're talking about major car manufacturers are retrofitting their plants right now to make, you know, respirators. And because the president is clearing away the cobwebs of all that regulation. So we're seeing an example of sort of this more liberty-ish think is probably the best path forward to solve the problem we're facing.
Yeah, I'll say two things in response to that. First, I don't know if you saw it. There was a tweet that went sort of semi-viral by somebody with a rose in their Twitter name. So it was one of these democratic socialists who said, late stage capitalism looks like capitalists want you to believe socialism looks like. And it was pictures of these empty shelves from from the sort of run on toilet paper and these kinds of things. Well, of course, the difference between America in the coronavirus epidemic or pandemic rather, and Venezuela is those shelves were restocked the next day, yep, if not a few days later.
Right.
And so that's the difference between capitalism and socialism, that even right, under tremendous economic pressure and societal pressure from a pandemic,
right,
our shelves are stocked in most stores within a matter of days, as opposed to a matter of weeks.
Right.
The second thing as it relates to these regulations and private sector actors, there's a headline making its way around saying Bill Gates, Jeff Bezos, and some other very rich individual are doing more to stem the coronavirus pandemic than our elected officials are.
Wow.
And that is supposed to elicit from the reader this response of a gasp.
Right.
That how can these private sector actors and philanthropists be doing more than our government is? Our government must need to do more.
Right.
My response to that, of course, is that's incredible and what I would hope would happen.
Right.
That I would hope that the private sector and the philanthropic sector would step up to the plate in a way that government simply cannot.
Right.
And help us get through this. And I think you're seeing that on the philanthropic side from some of what they're doing. I think what Amazon is doing to ensure that folks in some of the more rural parts of the country can get the needed essentials that they need that may not be available at their Dollar General or their local grocery store, I think has been incredible. And I think we will look back at this time period and look at some of the regulations that were suspended or eliminated as a part of it, and ask ourselves the question why they were there in the first place.
Yeah, I think that's the beauty of it. And going back to that tweet you were talking about, the ignorance of it, you mentioned that the shelves were stocked, you know, the next day. Every grocery store, I've been talking to some of the people that do the stocking. I'm just, you know, I'll go to the store and I'll be like, hey, how's things going? You know, first of all, I'm thanking these people because they're overworked in a lot of ways right now, and they have to come into contact with people. They don't know whether they have this virus or not. But I've been talking to them, and it's not that they're short on supply. It's that they can't put it on the shelf fast enough because we have a character problem with a certain small sector of the population that thinks they have to buy all the toilet paper. But in terms of the actual supply chain, all of this stuff right, is there. And if the supply chain wasn't there, then Kroger wouldn't have announced that they're going to hire, what was it, 100 and, like, there was some ungodly number. It was in the tens of thousands of people that they were going to hire. Maybe 150,000 workers or something nationwide. Maybe I'm totally overblowing that. But they were going to hire tens of thousands. If the supply wasn't there to put back on the shelves, they wouldn't need to hire new workers. So
right, the
evidence that the supply chain is fine is overwhelming.
Right. Absolutely. Commissioner Ryan Quarles, who's the agricultural commissioner here, has said similar things as it relates to food production. We are not at a crisis point as it comes to those kinds of things. It's just about getting stuff to the people who need it,
right?
And ensuring that we can sort of all weather this together.
Yeah, but can the farmers plant their fields? Are they able to get their seeds? I mean, because that's the only other concern I have. If you want a real supply chain disruption, it's, you know, screw around with the fact that right now is planting season. So there's a crucial window here. Are they able to get what they need?
As far as I can tell, that is still the case, that there is not an issue there, and farmers are producing. And I believe that the agricultural industry and farming was just declared as a part of these emergency regs an essential industry.
Right.
And so they will sort of get the benefit of that so that we can ensure that they do get whatever it is that they need.
All right. So, the Pegasus Institute, are you guys prepared to help the state if they decide to come together with an economic panel? I think you guys should sit on it. I'm sorry, I'm really pushing for this. I think every state needs to have a post-corona reemergence plan centered on the economy. How do we get business back up and open? I think once we have our hospital capacity taken care of, you can let younger, healthy people get back to work, and you can ask the elderly and the people with immunocompromised situations to maybe stay home for another month or two until this thing blows over. But once the hospital capacity is where it needs to be, I think at that point, since the vast majority of people aren't hugely negatively affected by this, it might be best to let herd immunity develop and let people go back to work. And then the other benchmark that I would have is once testing capacity is at a place where we can say to employers, look, one of the caveats to reopening your business is this. You have to give us a plan for how you're going to separate people, number one. And number two, you have to test every employee once a week, once the testing is up to capacity. Once those things are in place, hospital capacity, testing capacity, I see no reason why America can't reopen for business.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely the case, and I think that has to be the case. Our former executive director, Jordan Harris, had this post on Facebook over the weekend that it would have been incredibly irresponsible for our leaders to not shut everything down for 2 weeks to try to flatten the curve. It will come to a point, though, where it is as, if not more, irresponsible to completely disrupt and shut down the U.S. economy for longer than that,
Right.
because that comes with as much long-term pain
Yeah.
as this virus does.
Well, what can we do? You have an enormous amount of contacts with the state legislature. I know I'm texting everybody I can in the state legislature, saying, look, let's get this together. I'm not claiming my ideas are the ones that are perfect. I just want people talking about it. And now more than ever, let's get both sides of the aisle together and come up with a common solution, because for the most part, people seem to be fairly unified, the exception of what's going on Capitol Hill today. But, you know, what can we do?
Yeah, I think part of it is what we're doing right now is amplifying this conversation and sort of turning the page to this conversation.
Right.
The public health officials and the scientists and the doctors are much more capable than you or I of handling the medical side of this.
Right.
And so when it comes to what comes next, that's where I think we can be particularly helpful in crafting policies that can help the state recover from what is really no one's fault, at least domestically. It's not like the 2008 recession in that way, where there
Right.
was a whole bunch of garbage in the market that needed to be purged,
Right.
and there were folks who needed to be held accountable, and bad government policy had contributed to it. This is about as unforeseen and about as innocent as both business and government and anybody can be in an economic downturn like this. And so by recognizing that, how can we capitalize on that fact, capitalize on the fact that before this, the economy was in a very healthy place by most metrics, and we can turn the page.
Well, and I think that's the bright side to this. You know, I was listening to a podcast yesterday about a famous explorer, a guy that adventurer who was the first person to cross the Antarctic unsupported and unassisted, meaning he pulled a 300-pound sled across the Antarctic completely, about 700 or 800 miles. He did it all without any assistance, any resupply, and just pushing it himself or pulling it. And he was talking about life, and he said, life is, you know, on a scale of 1 to 10, 1 being the worst day of your life, you lose a loved one, something you feel like you can't recover from, and 10 being the most incredible joy that a human being is capable of actually possessing. And he said most people live their lives in between, stuck in a, you know, kind of quiet desperation between 4 and 6, because they're afraid to experience the ones, so they don't risk enough. And he was like, you got to have to have the tens, you got to have the ones. And it made me think, and I was like, you know what? This is a one. You know, what we're experiencing right now as a nation is a one. It's unprecedented. It's never happened before. It's on the scale of, in terms of severity, the Civil War, World War II, World War I, you know, the stock market crash of 1929. It's a one, but there's a 10 on the other side of this. And so I asked people in my post, I was like, what are you doing to plan to get your 10? You know, how are you planning to turn this one into a 10? And the reason I bring that up is the bright side to this is, as bad as this is, the fundamentals of the economy were fantastic. So if we can just get our leaders to see through, once we get those capacities up, we ought to be able to come back quite a bit faster than, say, some of our other nation neighbors.
I think that's absolutely true. I think from an economic standpoint, from a policy standpoint, that's true. And I think from a broader life standpoint, that's true. I think the closing of church building doors has, for a lot of folks, made them realize how much they needed not only the sort of spiritual needs of attending a church service, but the community and person-to-person needs that are offered by being a part of a congregation.
Right.
I think folks spending time at home over the last week and spending a lot of time with their spouse and their kids, for the most part, has made them realize that they should probably spend more time with their spouse and their kids. And so as awful as the circumstances are under which we've come to those realities, not only is there a potential economic recovery on the other side of this, but there's a realignment of priorities for people that I think could be really, really positive.
I 100% agree with everything you just said there. Josh Crawford, the Pegasus Institute, thank you for what you guys do. Let's hang in there. Let's push our leaders. Let's see if we can't get people talking about the economic backside of this so we can get to where both of us know we want our country to be. Thanks for your time this morning.
Thank you, Leland.
All right. Yeah, this good stuff there. And of course, the Pegasus Institute posting those numbers about testing, I think, is key. And that, I'm just going to tell you right here, these are the benchmarks. When you get enough tests available, and I'm talking about these new approved fast tests, the ones that can tell you within a couple hours, you once you get those tests, then you say to employers, look, open your doors, show us a plan for how, like if you're a restaurant, don't sit anybody booth to booth. Don't sit anybody table to table. Open up at half capacity until we get through this. But you can go ahead and open your doors back up. Businesses, show us how you're going to separate people about 6 feet apart. We know that they're not going to necessarily follow it, but show us your plan for trying to keep that out there. Do that. And then test every employee once a week with these tests that come back in an hour or so. Test every employee. Once you do that, let's let the young, healthy people get back to the business of running America in that sense. And I'm not minimizing the elderly. That's not my point. There's a lot of elderly that need to work too. But let's get the vast majority of the workforce, which is between, say, the ages of 20 and 55, let's get them back out into the workforce as quickly as possible. Once capacity for the hospitals is up to par, then let's ask the elderly and the people with immunocompromised situations to please stay home for another couple of months until we get this thing completely licked. But let's do that and start to roll the economy back out. And it's going to bounce back if we do that. But if we don't talk about this, if this goes on indefinitely, people are going to lose hope. And if we don't start seeing from our politicians, if we reach this benchmark, we can do this, people are going to start, the poverty is going to set in, desperation is going to set in, violence, unrest, social, economic chaos will be next. So consider this. I'm saying this as a warning to those of you who are in leadership. Understand this and understand it well. This will be on your shoulders if you don't take action to lead on getting us back to the place we need to be economically. If you don't give people hope, if you don't give people a sign, if you don't give people benchmarks, if you don't give them leadership, there will be desperation which will descend into chaos, a lack of rule of law, violence, and desperation, and people will die. That will happen. And if it's not dealt with quick enough, I'm telling you right now, this chaos will kill more people. This destitution, this depression that's coming will kill more people than this virus ever dreamed of. But it can all be avoided by some simple, basic steps. Put together an economic council. Put together the benchmarks. And say to people, be honest, be upfront. Look, if we're not at this place in 2 weeks, we can't do what we plan to do. But if we are at this place in 2 weeks, we can open back up. people will understand if we have to extend that deadline, but you've got to give dates that show people that this isn't a 2-year, 4-year, that this isn't forever. And if our leaders don't do that, we are going to be in a world of hurt. But I have confidence. I have faith. I sent an article about Colorado putting together an economic council to several legislators just the other day. All of them responded positively. Let's see if we can't get this thing rolling. Please share this podcast with your local metro councilman, your local city councilman, your local magistrate, your local state legislator, your representative, your senator. Send it to them. We've got to get this conversation underway. All right. Hey, you know what? This week, at some point, I promise we're going to take a break from the coronavirus, because it can't all be about the coronavirus. There's other things going on in our lives. We're going to talk about the connection that we're getting from our families. And Cameron's going to join us again. We're going to talk about being manly men. So that's coming up on the podcast as well. Thanks for listening. I'm Leland Conway. You can follow us on Twitter. It's at Zone Disruption, because some jackwagon took Disruption Zone. And I am at Leland Show, L-E-L-A-N-D Show. You can also hit us up on the Instagram. It's at GreatLeLondo and at The Disruption Zone. Let me ask you a question real quick. Do you want me to get a text line so that you can text the podcast, similar to the way you used to do to my show, and text the podcast? Now, it won't be real time because I don't broadcast these live, but I'll be able to check those texts, get those texts from you, and maybe respond to some of them. You can tell me what topics you would like to cover, information that you'd like to get out, that kind of thing. Do you want me to do it? So if you want me to do it, go to the comments section on the website, thedisruptionzone.com, and let me know that you would like to see that happen, or just hit me up on Facebook. You can DM me there. But if you want me to set up an official text line for the podcast, let me know. DM me on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, or go straight to the comment section on the website, The Disruption Zone, under this episode. Share this episode with your legislators. Share it with your friends. You can download us. You can subscribe to us for free at Apple Podcasts, Google Play, wherever podcasts are found, Spreaker as well, SoundCloud as well. We're on all of those platforms, so make it happen. And thanks to our co-executive producer and my co-host, Cameron Mills. Thanks to Dynamics Audio Productions for their help as well, dxaudio.com, and lots of appreciation. Just keep on listening. Share this with everybody. Thanks. I'm Leland Conway, The Disruption Zone. Go.